This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Martin Luther King Jr. Day is a time to remember an iconic civil rights leader and the movement he helped shape. This year's community celebration in La Crosse in honor of Dr. King will feature author, professor, and advocate Duchess Harris. Chair of the American Studies Department at McAllister College in St. Paul, Minnesota, Harris has been a leader on addressing civil rights issues in Minnesota and the region. Joining us today to talk about the ways Dr. King's and other civil rights leaders' messages are still relevant today is Duchess Harris. As I mentioned in the intro, you'll be giving the keynote address at the La Crosse Community Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. celebration next week. And so I wonder if you can share a little bit about, you know, what you're planning to talk about in your address.
Sure. I am delighted to have been invited to do this keynote. I think that 2018 is a significant year because it is 50 years since the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And so one of the things that I will be talking about is the notion of chaos or community. But the title of my talk will be Choosing a Paradigm of Service to be a Drum Major for Justice.
Fill us in a little bit about, you know, what that means and why this message is relevant for the La Crosse community.
You know, I think that the message will be relevant for the La Crosse community, but I'm hoping that the nation at large can take something away from what I will be saying on MLK Day. And I will be talking about some of the things that Dr. King said during his I Have a Dream speech that are rarely mentioned. I will be talking about his critique of hypercapitalism and hypermilitarism. And I think that, you know, his position also against Vietnam. And all of those things are things that we are talking about today.
Yeah, Dr. King was, you know, he was an iconic figure of the civil rights movement and is just associated with, you know, activism and nonviolent protests and all of these different issues. And, you know, in light of the civil rights issues we continue to face across our country today, you know, I wonder if you could talk about, you know, how remembering Dr. King's message has maybe become even more relevant as we address these issues and really take a look at these hard issues.
Well, I mean, I think it's more relevant because I think people need to study King, and instead of just focusing on what he said about having a dream, he also said that he was a drum major, and he said that he was a drum major for peace and for righteousness, and that other shallow things will not matter. And so that is critical at a moment like now. And, you know, he talked about what it meant to receive the Nobel Peace Prize in a moment where the notion of peace was contested.
You know, it's been more than 50 years, you know, since the civil rights movement, but many of these issues still exist in our country. And, you know, I wonder what your thoughts are on why we haven't been able to overcome, you know, many of the issues that Dr. King worked to address.
I mean, I think we haven't been able to overcome those things because I think often if we have a shared agenda, we don't know how to execute it. And I also think that, you know, sometimes people get confused as to, you know, what they need as citizens in the nation.
Can you, you know, explain a little bit more about what you mean by, you know, what people need as citizens?
I mean, what people need as citizens, in my humble opinion, is to coexist with a level of respect that often we don't have for each other. We don't necessarily need to agree, but we need to have some kind of common ground. Look, one of the things that Dr. King said in his I Have a Dream speech that people don't often think about is he says, in a sense, we have come to our nation's capital to cash a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American was to fall heir. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the unalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I, of course, would, you know, edit that to include women. And King goes on to say that it's obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come marked insufficient funds. And so I think that one of the things that King was getting to was not just that we have no compassion for people who are impoverished, but we also refuse to believe that there is an impoverishment in the bank of justice, that the bank of civility is bankrupt.
Some really powerful words from Dr. King. You know, I wonder what your thoughts are on what we need as a country and as a region, you know, to move forward on these issues. What are the missing elements that can really help us make progress?
I mean, I think we need to have, first of all, coherent understanding of what some public policy concerns are. I think many Americans aren't really familiar with what is going on with health care, what is going on with the tax plan. And if they are familiar, a lot of people have not been empowered enough to lobby their elected officials to ensure that their needs are being met. And that's what's critical. I mean, we live in a nation where people should not feel that they are going to be bankrupted by the tax system, and people should have access to health care in the 21st century.
How likely do you think we are to see progress on these issues in coming years?
One thing that inspires me, of course, is that every action has a reaction. And so if you take the current Me Too movement, for instance, at this point, which was actually started by an African-American woman, and a lot of people don't know that, her name is Tarana Burke. You know, the notion that we are going to stand for institutional systematic patriarchy, for instance, I think that there is a tremendous movement against that right now. And so I think that often when you have what people find to be difficult times, you have resistance to that. Like, that's what history has taught us.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Duchess Harris, author and American Studies professor from McAllister College. She's here with us today ahead of La Crosse's Martin Luther King Jr. Day community celebration, where she'll be giving the keynote address. You know, as we reflect back on Dr. King's time and the civil rights movement, you know, I wonder what you think those civil rights leaders would think of many of the current civil rights movements we're seeing, you know, things like Black Lives Matter and many of the social media campaigns. I don't know. What do you think that their thoughts would be on the current, I guess, evolution of these movements?
Well, I mean, fortunately, many of our civil rights leaders are still alive. I mean, you have Congressman John Lewis, who was in his early 20s when he walked across the Edmund Pettus Bridge. And so, you know, Congressman John Lewis knows what it means to say Black Lives Matter. And he's been saying that for 50 years. On December 28th, Recy Taylor passed away. And Recy Taylor was a Black American woman who was gang raped on her way home from church. And she was a part of a movement that pushed against Black women's bodies being exploited. And she went to the Montgomery, Alabama NAACP. And her advocate was none other than Rosa Parks. And this was 11 years before the Montgomery bus boycott. And so I think that the women who are alive from that generation, and even the ones who aren't, their daughters are pleased to see that the work that was started so long ago continues, and that people are actually learning that a lot of this work came from the African-American community, but communities throughout the nation benefit from it.
What is one thing that has improved since Dr. King's time? You know, is there something that we've made progress on?
I mean, I think we've made progress on something that I would call the politics of possibility. And so I think that we have enough people who have done things that at least a younger generation has a vision for the possibility of doing things that, you know, my parents' generation could not have foreseen. And so even though it doesn't, you know, structurally lift up 14 million people, it does leave us with inspiration.
And, you know, maybe the converse of that, you know, is there a new challenge that has arisen since Dr. King's time?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the things that we face in a way that we weren't facing during Dr. King's time is the prison industrial complex. And we weren't facing mass incarceration the way that we are now. And just that one issue alone is really undermining and disrupting communities in a way that is detrimental and will have lasting impact for decades.
I want to transition now. You know, you have also written a number of books in your career, and one of them is called Hidden Human Computers, The Black Women of NASA. And I wonder if you could first share a little bit about, you know, what this book is about.
Sure. So in 2016, I co-authored this book with a woman named Sue Bradford Edwards. And what we did was talk about the black women who worked at NASA starting in World War II. A lot of people don't realize that the work started then. It didn't start in the 60s. One of the things that drew me to writing about this is that the entering class of 11 women that launched this in 1943 had one woman in it who happens to be my maternal grandmother. And so that was my inspiration for telling this story. I've known this story my entire life. What's ironic to me about this, however, is that the year before I wrote Hidden Human Computers, I also co-authored a book with Sue entitled Black Lives Matter, and with the same publisher. And there were very different responses to the book. And so one of the things I ask people to consider is, why does the study of dark matter, and of course, you know, I'm referring to, you know, NASA and outer space, why does the study of that by black women have more value than black lives actually mattering? And just that question alone makes a lot of people uncomfortable. But I think it's important because a lot of people don't realize that the descendants of the black women like NASA, like me, can exist in the space of, you know, that fortune and that privilege, but also still be supportive of the Black Lives Matter movement.
As you mentioned, you know, you have a personal connection to these stories. And I wonder if you could talk about, you know, when was the first time did you hear about your grandmother's work as a mathematician at NASA?
Well, you know, I was named after her. My legal name is Miriam. You know, I've gone professionally and socially and personally by the name Duchess since I was a small child. And so I always knew of her work. She actually passed away before I was born. She passed away in 1967. I was born in 1969, which, of course, was the year that we landed on the moon. And so my parents couldn't think of anything else to name me but Miriam. And so I've known this story, but I also knew that my grandmother wasn't just a mathematician and wasn't just, you know, a matriarch of the bourgeois black elite in Hampton, Virginia. She was also an activist, and my grandmother was the one that removed the segregated signs in the NASA Langley. It wasn't the character that was played by Kevin Costner. And so I've always understood that it was not a contradiction to be a white-collar professional and invested in racial equality and uplift.
How has knowing her story and the stories of these women at NASA, you know, influenced your life and your work?
Well, it's influenced my life because I think the power that we have is to tell our stories and insist that people not only hear them, but believe them and honor them. And it's always given me the sense that if she could do this, you know, what were my limits? And so I was fortunate enough to grow up not seeing many limits.
You know, now these stories, you know, as you mentioned, there's been a movie about these, you know, women at NASA called Hidden Figures. You know, I wonder what your thoughts are first on the movie.
You know, I think that the movie had a very important role of making this story everyday knowledge. And so I would say that in 2016, if you asked most Americans if they knew this happened, not only would they have said no, they probably wouldn't have even believed that it happened. Now, people who haven't even seen the movie know that at least occurred. I actually have a different artistic vision for the story being told. My book, Hidden Human Computers, has now been adapted by Stages Theater, which is located in Hopkins, Minnesota, and they are going to stage it as a play in October of this year. And they also will be consulting my mother, who is turning 82, to give a more accurate representation of the struggles that her mother went through that don't necessarily get depicted in a Hollywood film.
What's it like to see these stories? You know, as you mentioned, people who haven't even seen the film, they know that these women were part of NASA and were an influential part. I mean, what is it like to see, you know, those stories be told on a national stage and now with this play, you know, to go from hearing about this with your grandmother on a very personal level to see this now be part of a national conversation?
Well, I mean, it's affirming for me because, you know, my mother has lived to see this happen, and she grew up with people telling her that it couldn't possibly have been true. And I have three children of my own who will grow up with people understanding what their context is. And that's something that people take for granted. But for those of us that come from communities that people haven't heard of, we end up being illegible. And what I mean by that is that people meet us and can't read us. They can't understand us. And it's not easy growing up as a child when people don't understand who you are. And so I feel really fortunate that my kids aren't growing up like that.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Duchess Harris, author and American Studies professor from McAllister College. She's here with us today ahead of La Crosse's Martin Luther King Jr. Day community celebration, where she'll be giving the keynote address. Last January, you know, the Women's March really seemed to kind of kick off a year of bringing discrimination and sexual harassment of women to light in this national conversation. In what way does this lens really make, you know, the stories of the Black women of NASA that you talk about in your book, Hidden Human Computers, you know, in what ways does that lens make those even more powerful and relevant?
I think it makes it more powerful because depending on how old you are, you might think that sexual harassment is a new thing. And so I think it's important for women who are the first to step forward and say, these are the things that we've been through, and we can collectively come together and we can move beyond this. And I'd like to take this opportunity to say that, you know, the Me Too movement and everything around that has inspired me to write a new set of books. And so I am in an exclusive contract with Abdo Publishing, which is located in Edina, and we are putting out a series, which is a collection of books that we're just launching now. Then the original set of titles are 24. And we have one set called Being Female in America. And it's a 6-book set. And the titles are Growing Up a Girl, Male Privilege, Sexism and Race, Sexism at Work, Sexism in the Media, and the one that I'll be talking about the most this year probably will be Sexism in Politics.
Why are these issues that you wanted to write about?
You know, my lived experience and hoping that I will live to see the change in leadership, right? And so women have entered certain professions, but we aren't necessarily at the top of the profession. And given the fact that we are at least 50% of the population, we should be at the table.
What are your thoughts on how we make progress on that issue to get more women at the table and in influential positions to really affect change?
Well, it's a pipeline issue. Like, it's all about mentoring. And one of the concerns about young women being mentored in whatever professional field that you pick is that up until recently, the mentors have been men. And as we have learned in the last 6 months, a lot of us knew this, you know, much further than the last 6 months. But now what has become public is the kind of behavior that women experience when they're being mentored. And so what you might have is a young 20-something woman who's trying to launch her career, and when her mentor is a 40-something or 50-something-year-old man who is inappropriate, not only do you end up becoming traumatized, you have just halted and stalled your career because you don't know where or how to report him, and doing that might not necessarily help, and you might not get much farther. Like, that is what the story has been, but many of us are hoping that that narrative will change.
2018 is another election year, and, you know, we're going to be seeing races for many, you know, state positions and national positions. I wonder how these issues, you know, things like the Me Too movement and the continued work of the Black Lives Matter movement, what role these issues are going to play in many of these races, do you think?
These issues will completely shape this, and I say this with confidence because in 1991, when we had the Clarence Thomas Anita Hill hearings, and no one believed Anita Hill, and Clarence Thomas was appointed to the Supreme Court. The following year, 1992, was a big election year, and that became the year of the woman, and we got more women elected to Congress and the Senate than had ever been. One of the issues with Clarence Thomas's confirmation, regardless of party politics, was that the Senate was made up of 98 men. And it wasn't necessarily partisan. There were Democratic men that voted to have him confirmed. And so I think that now that you have Me Too and Black Lives Matter, if you look at who's running for congressional seats and some of the gubernatorial elections, you see a push of women who are going through training programs, such as a program that I did years ago at Yale, which is called the Campaign School for Women, doing things like that launch them to be prepared to assume these roles.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Duchess Harris, author and American Studies professor from McAllister College. She's here with us today ahead of La Crosse's Martin Luther King Jr. Day community celebration, where she'll be giving the keynote address. Duchess, you've served on, you know, several statewide committees, from being appointed a Minneapolis Civil Rights Commissioner to serving on the Minnesota Governor's Council on Black Minnesotans, as well as, you know, serving as a co-chair for Minnesota's statewide Martin Luther King holiday. I wonder what you've taken away from this work about the state of civil rights in Minnesota and kind of the upper Midwest.
Sure. You know, I mean, I really love this work. I've lived in the upper Midwest now for 26 years, and so when I came to this area, I wanted to get involved. When I was a civil rights commissioner for the city of Minneapolis, I was appointed by Sharon Sells Belton, who many people know was the first black woman, not just to be mayor of Minneapolis, but one of the first black women to be mayor of a major metropolitan area in the nation. And I was able to do work locally in that community, which had value and impact for me because at the time I was living in North Minneapolis. Since then, being able to do the statewide work has made me appreciate how race relations can operate outside of the metropolitan area of Minneapolis and St. Paul.
Can you expand a little bit more on that issue?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that I've grown to appreciate is what immigration has meant in places like Rochester, what it has meant for people from the Somali community to settle in those areas, to learn about people from Eritrea and East Africa, and just how all of those issues are impacting how people exist as both folks in Wisconsin, but Minnesota as well.
I wonder what this work has also, you know, what you've taken away as far as the role of government in addressing these problems, ways that government can be effective and maybe ways that government falls short.
You know, that's really interesting. Like, I think that one of the things that I found to be most fascinating when I recently co-chaired the Martin Luther King event for the state of Minnesota, which was an appointment from Governor Mark Dayton, when we had that event, it felt very partisan to me, and I was very disappointed by that. And so, for instance, the entire leadership team for the Democratic Party was there, Congresswoman Betty McCollum, Congressman Keith Ellison, you know, appointed officials, so forth and so on. I didn't see members from the Republican Party there, and I know for certain that they were invited and that they were welcome to be there. And I was disappointed that the notion of what Martin Luther King had for America was not bridging that gap. And I hope as we move forward as a nation that we are able to think more about how can we come together at certain moments regardless of political affiliation.
Yeah, how do we separate these issues from political affiliation and really kind of come to the middle ground to address these issues?
You know, I think it has to deal with the kind of personal integrity that people have. And this is how we operate as human beings in the world. And so often I think it can be, you know, personality specific, right? And so, you know, when George W. Bush was president, for instance, he was the person that said that we should have an African-American Smithsonian. And so he was able to launch that and to get that through Congress and thought that that was a space that had value. And so it is possible, right? Like, this is not an issue of the Democratic Party. It just depends on how you perform in your role when you have these leadership positions.
You know, a lot of times these issues can feel really big and systemic and overwhelming, I think, for people. I wonder what your thoughts are on ways individuals can make a difference on these issues in their own communities and lives.
You know, I think that it's really important to just start where you are. One of the things that I have valued is speaking to predominantly white churches. People have invited me just to speak to their congregation. And I found that to be valuable because people are genuine. People might not know many African-Americans, might not be familiar with African-American history or culture, but they're open to learning and listening. And so I think that if we start always locally, right, if we start in schools, like if schools decide that they would even consider teaching the books that I've written for 3rd to 12th graders on social justice issues and having conversations about them. That to me is plenty. Everything doesn't have to happen with someone running to get a gubernatorial appointment, right? That isn't for everyone, and it's not even necessary.
Why do you think education on these issues, whether it be, the history of African Americans or really just, education about some of these social issues that are really relevant in current affairs, how is that education piece crucial?
I think it's crucial because we can't even disagree if we don't know what we're talking about. And so a lot of people think that education can blur the line with indoctrination. And I am a firm believer that facts are just facts. This doesn't have anything to do with opinion. People should have facts. And once you actually have those, then you can form an opinion. And so my experience of being in the classroom at McAllister College for 23 years is that I often start the semester with a disadvantage that some of my colleagues might not have. And so I have a good friend who teaches math, for instance, and I would say to her, have you ever had a student who hasn't had calculus? And she would say, well, of course not. You can't get into college without having had calculus, or at least, a college like McAllister. And I would say to her, well, I have advanced students, no first-year students, sophomores, juniors, and seniors in my class, and they've never heard of Paul Robeson. And it's going to take me 8 hours to get the entire class up to speed just so we can get started. That's a problem.
On this Martin Luther King Jr. Day, what do you hope people kind of remember, whether they attend community celebrations or just kind of mark the day in their own lives? What do you hope people are thinking about?
I hope people think about service. I hope people think about what Marion Wright Edelman, who runs the Children's Defense Fund, has so eloquently said, is that, service is the rent that we pay to exist. Right, that we all can serve, and we can serve in different ways. And I think that we're living in a climate now where we have leadership that insists that people can serve us. And I think that that is a faulty framework, and I think that we need to consider serving others.
Author and professor Duchess Harris is here with us today to talk about her work and the challenges facing our country in addressing civil rights. She's here with us ahead of La Crosse's annual Martin Luther King Jr. Community Celebration, where she'll be giving the keynote address. Coming up, we'll hear from another advocate, this time from the fashion world. Maria Idrisi is one of the first women who wears the hijab to be featured in a major fashion advertisement. We'll hear how she's helping to diversify the fashion industry. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. To hear audio archives of today's show, visit our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Hope Kerwin. Maria Idrisi grabbed the attention of the fashion world and beyond about 2 years ago. She's one of the first hijab-wearing fashion models and the first to be featured in a global campaign for clothing company H&M. Recently, she came to the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse to speak with students about her experience, representing modest fashion and becoming a role model for women around the world. So you're here at UWL to talk about empowering women and breaking down misconceptions through your work in the fashion industry. So what do you hope people walk away thinking about?
So I hope that people, if they don't know who I am, get a little understanding of who I am and what I'm doing and what the kind of bigger picture is for me. And it's more about just showcasing kind of the journey that I've gone on as the first hijab wearing model, and then where I want to take that platform and what I want to do with it. And hopefully, whether you're in fashion or not, that whole story can inspire people in whatever backgrounds they're in.
Yeah, I mean, before the 2015 H&M campaign that kind of launched your career, it was my understanding you hadn't done any modeling. Mm-hmm. I wonder what made you want to do that ad?
Do you know what? I was still in studying in university, and it just paid good for one day of work. Literally, that was it. And I didn't think anyone would recognize me or know me, because they said, I'm just going to be in an ad for like 2 seconds. But then they did some editorial shots of me, and that's kind of the picture that kind of went viral. So yeah, that's the main reason. Just, I thought it would be a fun experience.
Did you have any reservations going into it?
I did ask them, because unfortunately the way Muslims are always seen in the media is not great. So when the casting director said they want a girl in a hijab specifically, I said, why? What do they want to do with us? And she said, no, it's a campaign to encourage people to recycle. So they just want to show that everyone should recycle their clothes. And I said, okay, that makes sense. I can do it.
And so in the last 2 years, you've kind of become a well-known voice for modest fashion. And, you know, I wonder, do you feel like that role existed before this whole campaign and kind of the response that you've seen so far?
I mean, in the last couple of years, I've seen so much happen, which is really positive. As much as people still feel it's very slow and the industry is not diverse, it is becoming more diverse. It's just a slow process. It didn't exist, I guess, as the whole like model title, but the whole issue for me is beyond modeling. It's just about the representation that lacks in the mainstream media, where we have got obviously Muslim people that are very influential and talented, but you wouldn't recognize them as Muslims. So young people don't really have them to look up to as a role model that they can identify with. So it didn't exist, I'd say, so much visibly, which is what I hope will start to change.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you ever feel, uncomfortable or feel like people want you to maybe speak for all Muslim women or speak for everyone who chooses to dress modestly.
Yeah, I did initially, especially because I kind of wasn't asking for it. I just got scouted, and then all of a sudden it's like, okay, that's it. You're one of the people that represent like a quarter of the world's population, which is Muslims. So it was a lot of pressure at first. And I just saw it as a positive thing. I thought, okay, this is just going to keep me more on point and more conscious of my actions and what I say. So I tried to take it as a positive thing. But the thing that I always focus on is just telling people I'm just being myself. Like, that's kind of what got me here, just being me. So everyone can get wherever they want to be just being themselves, as long as they're comfortable and confident with it.
You mentioned that, you know, you hope your visit here in La Crosse kind of, just brings awareness for people to kind of, you know, what your goal is, you know, what you stand for. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, what that is.
So my main points is obviously diversity, representation, and inclusion into the mainstream media. So we have obviously a lot of great role models and representatives towards maybe the East in the world. So obviously like Indonesia, which is the biggest Muslim population, the Middle East. But there are so many Muslims that live in the UK and the USA. And for me, it's just about having those people growing up that they can actually identify with someone when they watch a movie or when they listen to music or when they flick through a magazine. So that for me is one of the most important things, which is why I always feel it's beyond me being a model. That's just one like element of it.
Mm-hmm. And you said that, you know, you feel like there have been improvements happening over the last few years. Mm-hmm. What do you think is driving that change?
I think it's like an awakening with people. So it's all coming together. I mean, the whole Black Lives Matter movement, and then you've got this. Everything seems to have happened just at once, where a lot of voices that weren't really heard are now being heard. And that's why they say there's power in numbers, because all these communities are coming together and saying, you know what, we need better representation. And I think it's just all happening at once, which is why it seems like such a big thing right now.
What role do you think social media has played?
That's interesting. Yeah, a major role. I always say I think the Kardashians, like, I don't know how to say this nicely. They like caused a lot of pressure, I think, on a lot of people to use social media to drive it forward. But at the same time, they've given so many people opportunities that may not have been able to have opportunities, because now they can use social media and actually develop themselves through that. So social media has got a massive influence, even in my, even with me today, it's still like, oh, so how many followers do you have? And it's like, why does it matter? But yeah.
I wonder how you see social media's role in maybe, working to increase that visibility of, you know, people who choose to dress modestly, of Muslim women, you know, of people from diverse backgrounds. Do you think social media has contributed to that aspect as well?
Yeah, definitely. Because even though H&M, the campaign, kind of showcased this whole, like, modest fashion movement coming into the West, it was an industry that was very much booming for so many years. So there were so many designers, Muslim designers, Muslim bloggers, Muslim makeup artists, like so many influencers in that space. And it was just about the West kind of picking up on it, the mainstream media saying, you know what, wow, we've been sleeping on this massive industry. And I think once H&M did that campaign, it just allowed, I think, people to look into it more and see what was already existing.
And so how do you, you know, obviously, you know, the Midwest, places like Wisconsin, aren't necessarily known for their fashion industry, right? And aren't necessarily trendsetters here. I wonder how you see those changes maybe translating to places like this.
Well, hopefully this talk will be good that I'm doing here whilst I'm here, just to inspire people as well. The same way for me. Yeah, I'm from London, which is okay. It's like fashion capital, but at the same time, I had no fashion background. I was not in that world at all. So if I could get called a modest fashion influencer overnight or whatever, I think anywhere in the world we have access to. Like we said, social media, conventional media, we've got so much access to things now. So it's just about, yeah, it's just about wanting to do it and finding the way to make it happen.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Maria Idrisi, one of the first Muslim hijab-wearing models. She's visiting UWL to talk about how inclusion in the fashion industry and pop culture can help change stereotypes about women and Muslims. I wonder if you could talk about what are the biggest changes you've seen over the last 2 years since you've just kind of been thrust into this spotlight, kind of entered into this world.
So soon after the campaign, actually, Dolce & Gabbana did a buy a line with matching hijabs. So that for me was like, whoa, it can't be a coincidence that they literally did it a few months later. And then my friend, actually, her name's Nora, she was the first cover girl to wear a hijab, which also happened. And then L'Oreal got their first hijabi influencer in one of their campaigns. And then we've seen Halima. So for me, I've seen so much kind of role since then. The influence has been powerful.
What are you anticipating to be the biggest changes in coming years? You know, what are you kind of hoping for to happen over the next few years?
I mean, it is happening now slowly. I just hope rather than calling it we call it diversity, but sometimes it's just tokenism. And that's where I hope for it to develop, where it actually is diversity, where it actually is just something we don't have to think about. It's now I see so many campaigns coming out, and it's almost like they're trying so hard to prove that they are, you know, including other people of other backgrounds, and it might not seem authentic all the time. So it's just getting to a point where it's just completely normal. We see past religion, color, this, that. It's just literally a normal thing to have everyone represented.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, how do we know if these changes are surface level or if they're systemic changes?
Yeah, that's what's interesting. I mean, I don't know, I just go with my gut feeling all the time. I can never really put my finger and say, yeah, that's this or that's that. Sometimes you can just see blatantly it's tokenism. They just needed to fit that criteria. It's just everyone can interpret it, I guess, how they feel.
You've said in the past that modest fashion is not just for Muslim women. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about your thoughts on that issue.
Yeah. So when I first started, I didn't even know what modest fashion really meant, because for me it was like I wear a hijab, and then there was this whole world of modest fashion. I think it's just a more of an open minded way of saying like Islamic fashion, because otherwise if we labeled it as that, it would be so controversial. So, I mean, the whole concept of modest fashion, it that's what makes it open to everyone. It makes it open to interpretation. I get a lot of clothes sent from two girls from New York. They're Jewish girls and they have a modest line as well. So they're not Muslim, but they still want me to, you know, represent what their brand is, and I'm happy to do that. So it just shows that it is beyond being Muslim. It's open to everyone. Whoever, modesty has no religion, you know.
How do you hope that just more visibility around modest fashion will kind of impact those stereotypes about what is fashionable for women?
Yeah, so the thing is, I see this like modest fashion thing as it's not a trend. I have to wear hijab and I want to wear hijab. So it's something that is never going to leave me. So it can't be seen as like a gimmick or a trend or something. It's just about, again, including it into day-to-day life. And I see it more as like a lifestyle than just what we wear. So, yeah, and just being open to everyone again.
In what ways do you think that fashion is a tool for change?
It's so powerful. It's like film, music. These are things that young people are, and not just young people, everyone is interested in, and everyone has some association to. So fashion is just one tool to be able to kind of subliminally put out a positive message, or it could be a negative message, in a way that it's not in your face. So that's why I think it's such a powerful tool.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. Today we're talking with Maria Idrisi, one of the first Muslim hijab-wearing models. She's visiting UWL to talk about how inclusion in the fashion industry and pop culture can help change stereotypes about women and Muslims. You know, I think a lot of times people may be, write off fashion as being a very just surface level thing, right? It's a very, I wonder if you can talk about how changing the fashion, you know, changing stereotypes and having more inclusion in the fashion industry can lead to, larger changes within our culture.
So again, I think it is just the uniting of people in a way. So fashion is like a common factor that everyone can relate to somehow. So I could wear something that someone that's not Muslim and would say, oh, I love what you're wearing. And then we kind of just create this connection between people that we might not have been able to ever or thought of connecting with. So I think that's one of the main things as well, just being able to see the similarities that we all have rather than the differences. And fashion is a way of doing that, because I could like something that someone else likes who's from a completely different background of me, and we just share that common interest.
Do you think you've made an impact on the broader culture through your work, through participating in the fashion industry?
I hope so. I mean, I didn't plan to even like be here, so I'm really just enjoying this process. I'm learning so much as well. It literally happened overnight for me. So seeing the influence of what one campaign can do, it's incredible. And obviously what the media can do as well, just creating that story and putting it out there for everyone to read. So yeah, I do see how it has inspired and influenced. But again, like I said, that whole industry was beyond me. It was something that was already there. I had very little impact in that world. So it was just being able to kind of show people and direct them to, hey, look what our community is doing. It's massive. And now we're seeing the mainstream fashion, like even Marc Jacobs. I don't know if you saw the last runway show. He used all girls, like they were covering their heads in, you know, funky turbans. And just being able to see that influence now that we never really saw in the past is quite amazing.
Is there a worry that, there is a lot of talk about people being concerned with cultural appropriation as well, and kind of, you know, taking items out of context. Is that a concern for you?
Yeah, that was one of the things actually that came out of the Marc Jacobs runway show. A lot of people said, oh, should we like this, or should we be annoyed that we weren't included and he didn't use any real hijab wearing models or whatever? But I think as long as there is some sort of acknowledgement to wherever and whatever the designer is inspired by, not just from our community, just wherever it is, I think it is always respectful to show that acknowledgement to where you've been inspired from or who you've been inspired by. But that doesn't, I don't really call it cultural appropriation. I mean, I just see it as, well, we're obviously doing something right.
How do you hope that you are a role model to other, you know, women who, you know, maybe want to participate in the fashion industry or in an industry where they felt like they couldn't be?
I always like to ask them why, because I think a lot of people think the fashion industry is so glamorous and glittery, and it's really not. So I always am interested in asking, like, why a younger girl would want to become a model if she wore a hijab. Because ultimately for me, what my understanding of hijab is, it's like a barrier to not attract unnecessary attention, like based on your physical appearance. But if you use that platform to do something great with, then why not? So it's just about understanding why it is they want to do it and what they want to do with that influence. Is it just for money? Is it just for your own personal ego? What is it for? And I think that's always important to understand.
Maria Idrisi is one of the first women who wears the hijab to be featured in a major fashion ad campaign. I had a chance to talk with her about how she's influencing the world of fashion during her visit to UW La Crosse last fall. And that's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse. I'm Hope Kerwin. The executive producer for Newsmakers is John Gatto, and our senior news editor and producer is John Davis. If you missed part of today's show, including our interview with Duchess Harris, keynote speaker for La Crosse's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. celebration, you can find the audio archives at wpr.org/newsmakers.